This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. On Friday, San Antonio will begin its Dream Week celebration. There will be a citywide events and forums that encourage the community to unite and discuss issues of social justice in the manner inspired by the teachings, practice, and sacrifice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Here on The Source, we'll be covering topics related to Dream Week. One of the events is a reading and discussion of the book, Coming of Age in Mississippi. That's on Saturday, January 7th at noon at the Carver Library. And the community is invited. Ann Moody's memoir tells her story of growing up in the rural South under the boot of Jim Crow. Jim Crow didn't just happen in the Deep South. It's part of San Antonio's past as well. And there should not be a whitewashing of that local history. Our local Jim Crow targeted Blacks and Mexican Americans as well. And I hope that can be part of our discussion this afternoon. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments and memories of all this at 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. We're joined this hour by D.L. Grant. He is the manager of the Carver Library for the San Antonio Public Library, and they're hosting this event on Saturday. Barbara Bowie is here. She is with the Mississippi Freedom Riders, and she's got a lot of history to tell us. And with us also is Kerry Lattimore, Ph.D. He is the chair of the History Department at Trinity University. And welcome to The Source, all of y'all. It's great to be here. Great
for
y'all guys
to
be here.
Thank you very much.
Well, Barbara, I'm just thrilled to have you here because you're living history. And so I want to make sure that history does not fall off the page. You know, so tell us about your experience as working with the Freedom Riders.
Okay, well.
And where were you? You were in Mississippi, right?
I was born and raised in Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi. My brother, when the movement started in 60 and Martin Luther King, and I think that SNCC and CORE were organizations that got these teenagers together to start a nonviolent movement. And my brother became a part of that. It showed some frustration in him as far as the Jim Crow laws, because
sure, as I understand it, the Jim Crow laws were one of the things that they carefully regulated were integration on transportation, on buses, and they did not allow African Americans and whites to mingle on buses, and you couldn't go to cafes, and there was all sorts of hardcore rules about what you could and could not do, and this was a effort to challenge those rules. And confront them and say and see how that would play out and draw attention to the injustice that people live with every day. But it was an act of bravery for these individuals to take this on because they were met with fierce and violent resistance.
It was not seen as that by the Freedom Riders at that time. It was something that we had to do, because we had lived in the oppression and wanted to do something that would change and bring attention to those laws. Evidently, the law was on our side, but justice was not. And so,
sure, there had already been a Supreme Court ruling saying that public transportation had to be integrated, but that ruling was not enforced across the South, and particularly the deeper in the South you went, the harder that the resistance became. Kerry Lattimore, or History Department at Trinity University, can you talk about the Freedom Riders and what they did for the movement?
I think in a sense, when you think about the Freedom Riders and those Supreme Court decisions that we're talking about, the Boynton decision and the Morgan decision earlier than the Boynton actually happened in my hometown in Virginia. That's a little extra history there. The fact of when you think about buses engaged in interstate commerce, which is really what this is about, these buses cross state lines. And so can buses that cross state lines be segregated? That's a good question. Can amenities, like when you think about that, if you own a store at an airport, can that be segregated if you have interstate commerce coming through it? But in a sense, the Freedom Riders bring together people who are Black, people who are white, engaging in a sense for justice. And when you think about it, since CORE was one of the first really racially integrated movements, we don't really see a lot of that until the 60s, when you have young people from all backgrounds coming together and fighting, in a sense, for justice. And sometimes I think we forget that the Freedom Riders are probably mostly Black, but also include a lot of other people as well. And so I owe a tremendous debt to them and what they did. And so that's what it really means to me, is people coming together, fighting for justice, and coming from many different backgrounds to be on one accord.
So D.L. Grant, over at the Carver Library, you're hosting a reading and discussion of the book Coming of Age of Mississippi by Ann Moody, and it is a memoir, and it's so well written, and it's a great story. It's a beautiful read as well, but we see firsthand what it was like to grow up under the boot of Jim Crow, to come to the awakening of this social justice system has to change, and her confrontation, and then kind of at the very end, a disillusionment with that whole thing as
exactly.
So can you talk about that?
It was a wonderful book, and first of all, I just want to say it's a wonderful story. It looks at social justice. They were saying civil rights movement. We are now saying social justice. So I wanted to share this really great book with a larger audience. A lot of people in the Carver community read this book, but there were more who have not discovered it. And Ms. Moody passed away going on about 2 years ago. So I thought, we got to do this to honor her, and this is the most appropriate time. It's just a really fascinating story. And you talk about oppression. My God, she lived under such pressure. It was. She talks about the difficulty of her childhood. There was tremendous stress. You could walk out of your house and you didn't know what would happen to you by day's end. You might look at somebody wrong. You might not get off the sidewalk. It could be anything. It was a tremendous amount of pressure that she lived under, and that motivated her to become involved in the movement and risk her life. I could go on and on and on.
So it's a story of not just racial oppression, but also her as a woman as well.
It did. I'm glad you said that, because there are a lot of themes in this book, the mother-daughter relationship. So you can take away so many things from this, but most people do recognize Coming of Age in Mississippi for its pronounced handling of the civil rights movement, because that's what some of the most dramatic parts of the book are. Like one incident was the time where they were at the Freedom House that some of the young people operated out of, and there was talk going through the community that tonight they're gonna come and get y'all. And they thought, there's a saying, Zora Neale Hurston used to say, stuffing courage into your ears, and they were like, no, because we would've heard by now. And so it was investigated, somebody went into town. Yes, they really are the Klan. They're coming, and they did. They had nowhere to go. It was night. It was in this community where they were. It was difficult to get in and out. So the only thing they had to do to preserve their safety was to leave the house that they occupied, head out into the back where the grass hadn't gotten mowed. And they were out there for a good long time, but the gang of thugs did come, and they did look for them. They did not see them. They stayed in the tall grass, and the men did come again.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Our phone lines are open as we're talking about the book Coming of Age in Mississippi, about Jim Crow and the legacy of the civil rights fighters, the struggle, the Freedom Riders. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980. It's part of Dream Week in San Antonio. The Source continues after this one-minute break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Dream Week kicks off in San Antonio tomorrow. One of the events that will be held this Saturday at the Carver Library is a reading and discussion of the book Coming of Age in Mississippi, written by Ann Moody. And it is a book, I put it up there with Anne Frank. I think it reminded me of it because it is very personal. It is insightful. You put you in her shoes, and you just can't help but see her as a astonishingly sympathetic and intelligent storyteller. And I think that thank you for choosing this book and for doing this event, because more people need to know about it and need to read it. So, D.L. Grant, what kind of reaction are you getting from folks when you say this is what you're doing?
People are glad. It's always, we always want to do things that will bring attention to our circulation, our collection. We work very hard to have the types of materials that people are going to gravitate to. So this was an opportunity to show off what we have. And we have this book in the collection. We're like, well, more people should discover it. I started reading this book. My sister brought it home. We attended Sam Houston High School here in town. She brought it home from the library, and it was lying around the house, and I found it, and I started reading it. And it's a book that I revisit ever so often. It's that powerful, and it is refreshing to hear a young girl's perspective on what life is like. A lot of times we hear the male perspective, so it's good to hear a woman's voice telling, what was it like? And sometimes it's very funny. And a lot of times it's not. It's not a pretty story a lot of the time, but it's something you just got to read it. And it's profoundly entertaining. You will not put it down.
So we'd lost Ann Moody a couple of years ago. She left us this written history, but it's great. We still have living history with us. And people should take advantage of that as we have it. We have Barbara Bowie with us this afternoon, and you and your family were very active in the struggle for civil rights and doing this Freedom Riders. What brought y'all to that?
Well, I think, as my brother has said so many times, we suffered under the Jim Crow laws. And it wasn't something, it wasn't even a choice being brought up in Jackson, Mississippi. But knowing of some of the things in the surrounding rural areas, which were much worse. And so when the opportunity arose, we all had to get involved. Now, our parents did not want that. A lot of parents didn't know, you know, what their kids were doing. And especially in Mississippi, when Governor Ross Barnett decided that he had the right thing to eliminate this, and that was when the Freedom Riders went into the bus station, and they went, they were white and black, but they went on the side that said white only instead of colored only. So they brought the dogs out, they did everything, but they arrested them. And what our parents and what most of the grown-ups didn't know is that these kids were placed in the Mississippi Penitentiary on death row. So my brother spent, among hundreds of others, spent 39 days on death row. And they weren't just there. They stripped them of their mattresses, of their clothes. They hosed them down. They put 10 or more of them in a cell that would only hold one or two people. And so in a sense, they tortured them while they were there. And just for their nonviolent efforts to fight Jim Crow laws.
And all they were asking for was equal treatment, going to lunch counters, having yes. being able to access just everyday items, things that we take for granted today. Carrie Lattimore, chair of the history department at Trinity University, you just alluded to it yourself, Barbara, about the problem of disunity among blacks in the face of white oppression, and that's talked about quite a bit in this book. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
You mean the disunity as far as older versus younger?
Some people saying leave well enough alone, or yes. questions about right. tactics, you know, incrementalism versus demand for immediate wow. social justice today.
I think there's so many, I can understand all the angles if I'm a parent and I have three or four kids. I have a job. And for many African Americans, they were working jobs with white employers. And so if they were involved in those activities or seen as being too close to being involved in those activities, they may lose that job. A church pastor has to have associations throughout the community, or else his church might get bombed. So there are questions that older people have to deal with and younger people have to deal with. These things even occur back in slavery. I mean, when we think about it, the most likely slave to revolt would be a very young, unmarried, unattached slave because they didn't have anyone.
Well, they were all actually unmarried because
right.
they were not allowed
theoretically,
to marry.
I would classify them
right.
as.
They didn't jump the broom, you know.
Right, amongst themselves. But if they were unattached,
yeah.
They were more likely to be more of a rebel because they didn't have their children. They didn't have children that would be affected by their activities.
Mm-hmm. And remember, my parents, our parents, were kids of parents who had gone through slavery. And so one of the biggest things is that, you know, you're going to get killed. Because they had witnessed.
Some did get killed.
Yes, they did.
Yes, we
did.
In horrible ways.
Ways, yes. And I might say that the whites who were involved, anger towards them was even worse because they felt that they were deserting their race. And so, you know, that
the consequences.
The consequences, yes. And they've wanted to make examples so that, you know, other people don't follow.
I'm going to take a call here. The number is 210-614-8980 for you to join our conversation. We invite you. We'd love for you to call in. Bill is on the line. Hi, Bill. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Johnson here. I appreciate these gentlemen speaking to this subject matter, Mr. Grant and the professor as well and others. But it seems to me that in some ways this disease of racism and intolerance has spread across the land. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s in a little country town here in Texas, it was thought that all that kind of thing was restricted to the South, the Mississippis, the Louisianas, the Alabamas, the Florida. But it appears throughout this nation now there's a level of hate and venomous on the part of these people that is spreading. And I suspect the results of the election is an indication of that. And I think we as a nation really has to come to grips with what is, because that's just a fact. And it's something that we got to deal with. As black people, I would suggest that we go back to the old landmark. Let's start focusing on education once again. Let's start focusing on stable households and start focusing on decent things that we once held dear, as opposed to trying to keep up, you know, with the Joneses, spending $500 for silly pad tennis or some other kind of nonsense. So I appreciate what they're saying, but I hope the audience really understands what we dealt with as black people in this country. As far as I'm concerned, slavery was our Holocaust. You talk about Holocaust for other people. Well, that's certainly been ours, and it still lives on, the remnants of it. And the whole country won't succeed until we get this right. Thank you very much.
All right, Bill, thank you for the call. I want to play a sound clip. This is from the news reports from the Freedom Riders when that time was happening, and this is how some people were defending their opposition to what the Freedom Riders were working for.
I think that people who strive to gain social acceptance through although they're called nonviolent or passive resistance, they're the most violent. I also think that it is in violation to my civil rights. If someone can say, you must serve me, if a man owns an eating establishment, if he can't choose whom he pleases to serve or not to serve, that can affect me and you and anyone else.
Breaking bread is essentially a family custom, almost a sacrament. Now, when you claim that you have been denied equal rights in participating in something that is regarded as a family custom or sacrament, and insist on being recognized, you're getting into dangerous ground.
All right, those clips are interesting to me, and I would like to hear your reaction, Carrie Lattimore, about that as well. It seems like the same logic that they used at that time to defend their intolerance is still in being trafficked today as people defend their intolerance for all sorts of manner of people.
It seems to be natural in a sense. If you think about the Civil War and Reconstruction, the complaints about Reconstruction was that it was a federal intrusion of states' rights. The same thing comes up in the Civil Rights Movement, and we see some of the same things happening today. I think when we're challenged, we move back to, in a sense, our little silos, and we resort back to sometimes old ways, prejudices that we, because we just often don't know each other. I mean, segregation was a situation in which people lived next to each other, but they didn't know each other. They never interacted together, separate and unequal and completely apart from each other's real lives and experiences. And so it is kind of shocking when you think of yesterday, today, and perhaps tomorrow, that these same things exist, not just in the South, but also in the broader U.S. has always been. But also, if we look across the world, we see similar kinds of situations happening, particularly in Europe, an immigration crisis over there. So people resort back to, in a sense, a nationalism when they're challenged.
Right. So we need conversations. We need discussions. We need to get together. So talk about that, D.L. Grant, about what's happening at the Carver Library with Dream Week.
We love the dialogue that's spinning off this. We want people to talk. We want them to share their memories. We want them to know that this is just not a Mississippi story. This, I talk to people every day who have lived this, and what we want people to walk away from this thinking is that, you know, we don't want to revisit, you know, where we were. We want to keep moving forward. But you do have to entertain the past. In the Black community here in San Antonio, you felt pretty safe in your area. But when you walked out of the community, things can happen to you. Even in San Antonio, you felt safest in your community. And we had businesses. We had like taxi cab services. We had the whole hotels, nightclubs. We had a whole infrastructure here in San Antonio. You left that community, something could happen. But San Antonio clearly was not Mississippi. Another thing that's going to...
Sure, but we're not Mississippi is not something to be proud of. You know, there was still lots of stuff going on. San Antonio was still listed in the Green Book, you know, about where you...
very true.
Exactly.
So there were plenty of establishments where you could not go.
My parents talk about that. In fact, I talked to local historians, not formally learned people, but trained through formal education, but they will tell you, I've learned so much from their feet about what we can do to preserve, like cultural heritage is what I'm real big on. We can preserve our cultural heritage by holding on to the positive things that we learn from those experiences that like, how does a community stick together? Things like that resonate through this book. What holds a community together? How do we how we deal with adversity in a situation? It keeps us together. One thing that if you had just a moment, the whole voting issue that we have been talking about, like what, November, that was the thing that got a lot of people killed in this book. That was when the bigots really got riled, because when those young people went out in like 63 and around 64, they were trying. Yes, around that time, the young ones were going out on farms. They were going out talking to people who didn't even know what voting was. All they knew was how to sometimes work with the hoe. The canvassers would go out and look at these people, and they would catch themselves staring at their hands. And these individuals had calluses on their hands that were so massive or pronounced, when they saw you looking at them, they would hide them. So they had a lot of work to do. Their hands were really, they had a lot of work cut out for them. But that's one of the most fascinating parts that we could use of the book, that we could use to tie in modern times. I'm thinking about cultural heritage. I'm thinking about current issues like the voting issue. There's so many themes in this book that I think we're going to be able to talk about and have dialogues. And we're going to, do I have time to go into?
Quickly.
To discuss. We have a couple of upcoming discussions so that we could keep the dialogue going.
Okay,
at the branch.
We're going to talk about that we're going to get another half hour coming up here, and all y'all are going to be here, and we're going to talk more about this. We've got some callers lined up, and we're going to be bringing them into the conversation as we talk about Coming of Age in Mississippi, the memoir written by Ann Moody, and she talks about being under the boot of Jim Crow. She grew up, she was born in 1940, and she was there during the initial period for the civil rights. Our phone line is 210-614-8980 if you want to join our conversation. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our discussion of Dream Week and the selection of the book Coming of Age in Mississippi by Ann Moody. The community is encouraged to gather at the Carver branch of the public library on Saturday at noon for a reading and discussion of this fascinating book. We're joined now by Alisi Steele. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a journalism professor at the University of Mississippi. She's written the book Delta Jewels, In Search of My Grandmother. There's wisdom. Also with us again, we have D.L. Grant, the manager of the Carver Library branch, and Barbara Bowie. She is a Mississippi freedom writer. And also we have Carrie Lattimore, the chair of the history department at Trinity University. And our phone lines are open, 210-614-8980. And so, Alicia, let me ask you your beautiful book here. Thank you for joining us. And talk about I read why you wrote the book, but I loved the approach that you took, how you really wanted to bring to light a different side of Mississippi.
Well, hi, David. Thank you for allowing me to join in. I was listening to the show before I came on. I moved to Mississippi in 2012, and I was raised by my paternal grandparents. And, you know, when you're younger, you're thinking about everything besides your parents' history, at least I was. And my grandmother died 22 years ago, and when I moved to Mississippi, it just reminded me of my childhood with her in the South. She was from South Carolina, and I wanted to pick up the phone and talk to her and just talk about what her life was like. I wanted to know more about her, and I couldn't. That time had passed. And so with all of the skills that I have as a multimedia journalist, I thought, why don't I pay it forward and interview other people's grandmothers? I wanted my grandmother's contemporaries. And so I just set out to do it. I didn't know a soul, didn't know where I was going to get the stories, how I was going to get to them. And it took months to gain access and gain the trust of the pastors who helped me find the church mothers. So that's why I started the project, and it's changed my life forever. I mean, they're so precious, and I have to say that last night the ninth woman from my book passed away, and so it just hits home of why oral history is so important.
You bring to light these women who are so rich with dignity, and you show them in that manner. And when you see them around town or at events or at church, you recognize them right away for who they are. They have seen it all, and yet they have stories to tell, and we have to honor them with these. And you do that in your book. Can you talk about that?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I think everybody, you know, there's a show, Steve Hartman on CBS Sunday Morning that just captivated me when I was younger. He would pick a dart and throw it on a map and then go to that town and pick up the phone book and just randomly pick a name. And the idea is that everyone has a story worth sharing. And we do. We all have stories. And the challenge was getting the women to open up, to share some very painful things and some beautiful things, and making eye contact and putting mobile devices down and listening to them and being an active listener was a life lesson for me.
Right. And so I think that's critically important that we recognize that we're surrounded by living history, but we're not listening to it and we're not capturing it. And especially when it's so deep and personal, like at your own grandmother or your relatives.
Absolutely. I mean, we all have phones, and these phones have incredible things called microphones, and we can record their voices. And when I go to colleges and I talk to students, we take selfies, we take pictures of our food, we take pictures of our pets, we take silly videos, but are we really turning the phone around and photographing our elders and asking them what life was like? And that hit home for a lot of students. In fact, there was a community college who used my book as a textbook, and I go and I listen and I surprise the class because I wanted to hear their reports. They interviewed and then wrote essays about what it was like interviewing their elders, and one young lady was like, oh, I interviewed my grandmother, but I didn't record her voice. I didn't think to cut my phone on, and she died 2 days later. And so listening to that young lady talk about the pain of never hearing her grandmother's voice again, she didn't record her. And so I always tell people, use your phone to record those voices. Don't miss out.
So, but you're interviewing women who were in the Delta, Mississippi Delta, and I know you weren't deliberately trying to talk about the struggle for civil rights and the problems with social justice at the time, but that can't help but become part of the story that you tell.
Absolutely. I was listening to Miss Bowie and to Mr. Grant, and you know, I was relating because I remember some of the women in my book. Miss Myers, who lives in Ruleville, Mississippi, she talked about not being able to have lights on after midnight in their homes because police would come knock on the door and say, what are you doing? They thought they were having civil rights meetings. So I didn't even know that in certain areas in the epicenter, in the Delta, that you couldn't have your lights on after midnight, or you couldn't walk down a certain street to walk home from school. Or, you know, there's another woman in the book, Miss Curtisine Davis, and she was talking about the Freedom Riders coming to visit and how her parents, threatened to send her up north if she continued to go to the meetings, because the plantation owners didn't want the blacks to participate in the NAACP or voting rights or Freedom Riders. And so, you know, talking to the Freedom Riders, so I totally related and understood, because the women in my book, there's a range of topics from not being able to vote to falling in love to sending their firstborn to college for the first time. So there's a gamut of stories and history from these women.
Let's take some callers. Ron is on the line. And Ron, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to thank your the young lady that just spoke about her book. It was part of what my question was. I would really like to ask your panelists their thoughts on expanding this conversation beyond a week or a month and into the universities, where this information really needs to be heard by quite a few first-generation students who may not realize the burden that was borne that they might have that opportunity. Early on, it was attributed to Malcolm X that one of the things that hurt our community was the fact that so many, through integration, moved out of those communities. So we didn't have those type mentors and leaders around. And with that, many have moved out of the community and have left many of the older folks there. So I'm just hoping that your panelists might address what this work they're doing at the Carver Center might be expanded beyond the Carver Center into the academic world and made more extensive throughout the year.
All right.
And I'll take my answer off there.
Thank you for the call, Ron. And so, Barbara Bowie?
Yes, thank you for that, Ron. What the Bowie Foundation is about is, we call it bringing families together. For the Freedom Riders, we have put together a sort of a movement, but a program whereby we're bringing the Freedom Riders in at least annually. And we've been doing it for several years. And what we have found is that, for instance, we're doing three youth summits. One is in Austin on Tuesday, and we'll be at Tillotson, Austin-Tillotson University, Houston-Tillotson University. And the one that we've been doing for about 3 years is at Judson Independent School District. Now, and this year will be our first year doing it at SAISD, San Antonio ISD. What has happened is that these kids have shown us that they are absolutely interested in talking to these Freedom Riders and getting this history. They started a couple of years ago calling the Freedom Riders their living history. And this has been so important that at Judson ISD, they started out with 300-400 kids, and then the next year was 400-500. This year, they emailed me, and they said they have 800 kids coming to this youth summit and on Wednesday. And I think that that is a key. If we can, we want to continue doing these youth summits, because we were thinking that, you know, the kids won't understand or whatever, but they have really.
So they are engaged,
they
and they are hungry
engaged.
For this information.
They are hungry for it. Yes, they are. And so, you know, we have a series of events that we're doing with the Freedom Riders that not only include the kids, but
right. So a lot of opportunities. So in San Antonio, we're going to be having the tricentennial, the 300-year birthday for the city coming up next year. A lot of planning for that happening now. So that's a year-long opportunity to be talking about our history. And we need to be making demands today that that history that's being celebrated is inclusive and diverse and tells the whole history of the city.
True.
And so talk about that, D.L. Grant over at the Carver Library. Why is that important?
Because we know that, you know, we don't want to revisit the things that, that the bad things that happened in the past. We need to keep this alive. And it's an American story. This really did happen to us. It's part of our history, and everybody needs to know this. And everybody wants to have their contribution count. And people gave their lives. People endured hardships, endured privations, and things like that. And it's not that you want to hold on to hatred. It's about education. And what the library does is we offer outreach. We can always come out to locations where we can have dialogue. We can use our collection to help people be educated about the history, even local history. I'll give an example of something that I did not know. When I was a young person, I would walk past Joskies. People might remember the old Joskies or the old Woolworths. Now, what I did not know, when I was an infant, my family would not have been allowed, and this was in my day, I wouldn't have been allowed to go into the lunch counter.
Sure, the Joskies.
You couldn't sit down, but you could take your food and go, but you were not allowed to sit down. Right. You have to take it and leave.
So Maria Beria Zobel, the former San Antonio City Council member, she tells the story about how she was invited to go to the Joskies tea room, and she was not allowed in until she had special permission given because she was a Latina. So this is part of San Antonio's history as well.
You got to tell
the
story.
We got to tell these stories because we don't know where we're going. We don't know where we are if we don't know where we've been. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue the conversation. We're going to take some of these other callers. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to your public radio station in San Antonio, KSTX, Texas Public Radio, and this is The Source. We're talking about Coming of Age in Mississippi, the Ann Moody book, which is a book that people are asked to read during Dream Week, and they're having a discussion about it this Saturday at the Carver Library, and it is a compelling read. Once you read it, you will never forget it. It will change you because it is so well told, and it is a moving story, Coming of Age in Mississippi by Ann Moody. You can find it at Half Price Bookstore. You can find it at the library. It is easy to get hold of.
Online.
And you can find it online. So, yeah, go for it. And with us this afternoon, we have D.L. Grant, the manager of the Carver Library Branch. We have Barbara Boy. She's living history. She was part of the Mississippi Freedom Writers. Also with us is Alicia Steele. She is the writer of the book Delta Jewels in Search of My Grandmother's Wisdom, which is a beautiful photographs of some astonishingly beautiful and dynamic and proud and dignified women as they talk about their lives growing up in Mississippi. And Carrie Lattimore is here, chair of the history department at Trinity University. Let's get a caller on the air. Here's David. Hi, David. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is David Zamora-Casas, and I wanted to thank the panelists for their scholarship and the insight of this incredible history of the Freedom Riders and the stories of their survivors. As an artist, a gay and lesbian supporter, I've supported both communities. And this knowledge of the Freedom Riders has really inspired and informed my consciousness and my art. And I wanted the panelists to maybe speak of the connections of the women's liberation movement and the struggle of Mexican migrants and the gay and lesbian movement and how this is entwined with the Freedom Riders and our support for and our struggle and our quest for basic human rights. And I really want to let you know that my heart was in my on the floor listening to you. I'm just, you know, just so inspired by listening to the incredible words that are coming out of your mouth. And I want to thank you very much, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, David, thank you for calling in, and it's always great to hear from you. And so do you want to talk about how this is a matrix of people who need representation, and there's a matrix of opposition to them as well?
Right.
Carrie?
I think in a way, when you think about the 60s, and it's not that women's issues or these other issues only emerged in the 60s. They certainly didn't, just like the African-American civil rights struggle was a long struggle. But when you think about the 60s, what's interesting is that this is a point in time which all of these people sometimes are working together. You think about the Black Panthers and the people that they're working with, people of Chicano studies, the African-American studies, all of these things, the gay rights liberation movement, all of these movements are working in some sense sometimes in tangent with each other, and they're saying, hey, our struggles are similar. If you think about Chicano studies, the relationship in San Antonio and Texas, growing up in Virginia, we didn't know anybody who was of Latino background. That's just the way that it was. But here, I found out that people talked about, you know, racially and ethnically, they would talk about people in the same ways that I heard people talk about African Americans in Virginia.
Exactly.
So you see these similarities. People don't, you know, whites only or not, no Mexicans allowed, the segregation that happened in Texas, you would have to be blind to not see the connections and the intersections between all of these groups and the women's rights struggle, thinking about Black women, how do they work being black and a woman. So you think about the ties
or,
and all
or
of those
things.
Or
if you're black and a woman and you're a lesbian.
Gay or lesbian, certainly.
You're dealing with another issue, another layer of, you know, of something to have to fight through and establish yourself. And
we talk about it as intersectionality. You know, all of these things are intersected in a way. And yes. I think it was the 60s in which we probably got a chance to really see it through media, too. There were more opportunities for people to express themselves and to get the word out there.
Right. But there's nothing that beats getting out of your comfort zone, going to some place that you've never been before. Maybe you've never been to the Carver Library. What's keeping you? You know, your car goes there just as well as it goes to the mall. So let's go head over there on Saturday morning and check out this here discussion. It'll be awesome. Let me ask you, Alicia Steele, you know, as we talk, you focused on these women in the Delta and their struggle and their, but you wanted to show them as not, you know, the typical people in the ramshackle shack. This was not that. These were women who were really had a different kind of experience.
Right. Well, you know, being a photojournalist, I like to document people as they are. And, you know, but I'm dealing with elder women who love to wear hats for church. And they're not dressed if they don't have their hats. And so I wanted them to feel comfortable.
And the flowery perfume.
Exactly. And the pearls, you know. Some women wanted to get dressed up, and I allowed them to do that. And some women took, you know, had me take their picture as they were. The point was I wanted the pictures to be simple, elegant. Everything's black and white, and there's no flash. It's just me with one lens and taking their picture in their surroundings. And a lot of people get uncomfortable when photographers come in. How do you want me to be? What do you want me to do? I don't want you to do anything. I just want you to be. And I always took the pictures after I interviewed them because it gave us a chance to get to know one another, to share, and to break some barriers. And you can tell the difference. There's one woman in the book who wanted me to photograph her before I interviewed her, and you can tell that that connection's not there as much as it is for all of the other women. And so it was a beautiful personal history lesson for me. It was never meant to be a book. It was a personal project, and so it just changed. And out of that came my nonprofit, Delta Jewel Support Foundation. And one of your callers talked about what are you doing throughout the year. Well, we're telling stories. We're working with schools. We're working with churches, and we're helping youth learn how to record the voices, how to cut the audio, how to take the photographs, and put their own multimedia projects together, because it doesn't do us any good if we keep it to ourselves.
One more caller, John. And John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm a retired Army Master Sergeant, and I live partially in Cotulla, and then did my education in Philadelphia in program school. I enlisted in the Army. I went to Fort Lee, Virginia, when a few of my friends and I went to a diner, the KKK come in and requested a donation to their organization. If it wasn't for the waitress telling us, giving us the high sign, we would have been beaten up when we went outside. I got reassigned to Panama Canal, and an African-American sergeant befriended me, him and his wife. Didn't realize that discrimination was that bad in the service, and a group of white boys got together and beat the hell out of me. Yeah, this business of prejudice and is just unbelievable. I'm glad the Army came back and started supporting, you know, this business of not taking people down because of their race, whether it's brown or black or they're Asian or whatever. It's unbelievable. And we're still in a hole. I wish we would do something to get out of it. I just don't understand it. But anyway, go
Don,
ahead.
Don, thank you for your call. I appreciate your story, and thank you for your military service. And he tells a great story. And the Army has been one of our actually most socially progressive institutions that we have. They have been very at the forefront of integration, and some people say that's why San Antonio was so aggressive in integration, because of its military roots. Another caller, Carlos, is on the line. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, David. Barbara, I just wanted to say hi, and anytime you need my services, sweetheart, I'm there for you.
Thank you so much.
And so, so you're a photographer, Carlos?
Well, I'm an avid photographer. I don't do it professionally, but Barbara, whenever she's brought Freedom Riders down, I've helped her on a couple of occasions, and it's always been a pleasure. I really admire everything she's done. She's a gem to this city and to her culture.
Absolutely.
And to really, anybody that listens to her and the people she brings in, the stories they tell, it's a treasure.
Okay, we're losing you there. But Carlos brings up a great point that community support is critical. People can't do it by themselves. It takes, you know, you got to have people giving you from support from behind.
Most definitely.
And so, Barbara, you have events coming up you want to talk about?
Yes, I do. And I'm so happy that you're supporting the event at the Carver Branch Library. However, all week long, our Freedom Riders will be involved in events that free events that people can come. I mentioned the youth summits on the 11th and 12th. 10th, 11th, and 12th, but on the 12th, we do have a reception for the Freedom Riders at the Continental Cafe and Event Center on Fairdale Drive in Riddiman. But on January 13th at 6 o'clock at the Claude Black Center, located at 2805 East Commerce, the Freedom Riders will be there. We will be doing a film screening and panel discussion that will include audience participation. And then I think the most important thing we're doing a replica of the 1961 Freedom Bus Rides. Greyhound has agreed to participate with us. And what we're doing is, and I want to say I'm doing this in conjunction with the Northeast Partnership for Economic Development, which is made up of about 11 or 12 cities mm-hmm. Northeast. We will be, the Greyhound bus will start in Selma, Texas. And we will be coming through several cities on our way to Kirby for our annual MLK parade.
Okay.
And so we want people to come out and ride, get on the bus with the Freedom Riders.
Lots of opportunities for people to show their support. Also, real quickly, the movie Hidden Figures is coming out. I think that's a great opportunity as well. D.L. Grant, what do you think about that? Really quick, about 30 seconds.
We're very excited about this movie. We have been waiting for this to open. I have not gotten to the theater yet, but I'm on my way. Because we want to encourage these young women to get out there, see these examples.
Support
from
the
that.
Things that you support.
Support.
Amen.
Exactly.
All right.
And go to mysapple.org for other activities that are going to be celebrating this wonderful time in history.
Dream Week kicks off tomorrow, and the event is Saturday at the Carver Library. D.L. Grant, Barbara Bowie, Kerry Lattimore, and Alicia Steele. Thank y'all so much. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.